Thank you for tuning into the VF One Show with VF and Vincenzo, the podcast that discusses all things business, marketing, politics, and government within the world of Formula One. If that's your thing, then you found the right place. So without further ado, it's lights out and away we go.
Welcome back to the show. This is Vincenzo Landino. This is the VF One Show you're listening to. As always, I'm joined by my fantastic co-host, VF, aka Vanessa. How you doing over there?
You know, I'm good. I feel like there was a hangover from the race last weekend in terms of penalties, and we're still unpacking.
Just a little.
I might have PTSD from that, if I'm being completely honest. I'm like, what else mm-hmm. is gonna happen? How are you?
I mean, I'm great. I'm fantastic. Finally got a result that I liked. Kind of. It's a decent result for the boys, which was good.
Y'all were good.
Yeah, other than what's that?
I said, yeah, y'all were good. I mean, maybe they heard us talking so much shit about them. They're like,
yeah, they were good. I mean, it was good. I mean, I think. I think the maybe we should talk, you know, kind of jump in and talk a little bit about that as kind of our lead off, but FIA just continues to be, I mean, comical is the only word I can think of.
Yeah,
it's comical. It is. They said there was something like 1200 instances of track limits that they had to take a look at.
Yeah,
1200. And the only process they had or have is a process in which they get triggered as to when a track limits, but it has to be looked at. So all they get is a trigger notice or whatever it happened. But they then have to manually look at all of it.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, is this really the best? Like, I can't believe, you know, in football, we have goal line technology for, you know, the goal. We can see if a ball goes completely over, you know, over the goal line or not. In other sports, we have, you know, replays and all these other things. And you can get moderately real time. You know, answers to these errors. But with Formula One, you mean to tell me that this is what like eats at me, right? Pinnacle of motorsport.
Yeah.
And yet we don't have a way to make these calls immediately, you know, especially when you're looking at the technology and the sensors that are already in the cars, already in the tire. I kind of jokingly posted a link to one of the Adidas soccer balls that is used in football, and the ball has like all sorts of special sensors and stuff in it that don't really add much weight or doesn't throw off the balance because of the way it's done. And I'm thinking to myself, that's cool, right? Like that's awesome. And yet they don't have something like that can just automatically, you know, be used in Formula One tires. Now we know that there's sensors already in Formula One tires, right? They have like tire pressure and other, you know, other sensors that are reading numerous amounts of things. But you can't just provide a sensor. If it's triggered, it's over the line, you know, whatever penalty or you know, fourth time is a penalty. It really boggles my mind. Like, yeah. I really am boggled is the only word I can think of.
Yeah. I mean, in that race, there were 7 drivers that got in race penalties for track limits. And then they gave out 12 additional penalties to what, 8 drivers after the race? It's too much. it's too damn much. You know, it's like we talk about wanting to improve racing, but it seems like the agenda is improving the spectacle. Let's see how, and we'll talk about that much later, but I don't understand what they're doing. I mean, you get it. There's always going to be drama. There's always going to be track limit issues to some extent. But when it kind of forces other drivers to become police as sort of a tactic, it's looking at you, Lando Norris. That was actually really funny. It just, I think it kind of takes the purity away from racing itself. It's like when drivers are policing each other on track, it's like,
they all were,
but it's like, and they all do to some extent during the race, but when they're telling on each other, knowing that the FIA has to investigate pretty much everything that they hear on the radio, it's again, like, are they helping? Are they trying to help each other improve the racing, or are they just trying to, you know, hope that they can kind of skirt a penalty by and maybe jump, you know, leapfrog each other? And I get it. It's a competition. You want to do everything you can to have a competitive advantage. But I think we continue talking every week about wanting to improve the on-track product, wanting to improve the racing. And I think that when a track is designed so, you know, I'm not going to say poorly, but we'll just say uniquely, that track limits to that extent are that much of a contributing factor to the outcome of the race.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like, you know, to continue quoting loosely, Christian Horner, change your fucking track. You know, like change something about your track to stop that from happening. Cause I didn't enjoy that race particularly. It was too dramatic.
It was looking at Silverstone
last year. Yeah. But looking at Silverstone last year and the different on track battles that were going on, I mean, that was exhilarating. That's the kind of drama I want to see in Formula One, not like, oh, he's so and so just went over the curb again. Like that's, you know what I mean?
Well, and you know what? I'm actually not going to, I'm not going to say anything like, oh, Lando shouldn't have, or whoever. They all were. I mean, listen, Lewis got to the point where Toto had to come on the radio and be like, dude, just drive the car. We know it's not good. Like, And that's almost like sad that they have to do that. I did think Lewis was a little much with coming on the radio, like checking if other people were getting penalties. It's like, dude, it's not just you. Like, I don't know why they didn't tell him that. I almost felt like maybe they did. Maybe I missed it. But it's like, just let him know that, hey, by the way, everybody's getting penalized right now for this stuff.
Yeah.
I felt like that would have been a lot better use of.
Yeah.
Time than, you know, having him continue to come on the radio and have to say, like, is anyone else getting penalty? But there was a lot of policing of each other, rightfully so. Especially if you know that penalties are being handed out, you are going to want to continue getting your competitors penalized. I don't fault any of the drivers for that, but that's on the FIA for creating this.
Yeah.
Stupidity, if you ask me, like they created that, and that's what aggravates me, is that you're creating this environment where the drivers are, I don't want to say they're not focusing on the driving, but it turned, like you said, it's turning into just a track limits battle. Who's going to get the most penalties? Who's going to get the most I don't even know. It was terrible. And then Aston Martin, you know, good for them for pushing it and bringing that to the, you know, bringing that to the stewards after the race. I will say, like, hey, good for them for pushing it, because nobody else was going to push it. Yeah. It didn't seem like. And, you know, the fact that they they did that and they won that appeal, it just goes, and I think that sets precedent too, right?
Yeah.
Now, if you're a team, you're looking at it and you're saying, hey, if we push hard enough. And but here's the other thing. Aston Martin clearly had the data, which is also what pisses. There's so many things about this that just aggravate me. They had the data. Why didn't the stewards have this data?
Yeah. Yeah.
How is it that they have the data? And I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah. I think the irony of all of this too, is that, wasn't it Mossy that was very lax on the usage of carbs in races? And
yeah,
he was very sort of relaxed on that rule, you know? And then when he was fired, the new race director was like, absolutely not. It's almost like they wanted to take what happened at the end of 2021 and maybe say everything Michael Mossy was doing was horrible. Look what happened. So now we need to reverse everything he was doing. And I think that if you're going to fix things in F1, don't fix things that aren't broken necessarily. That wasn't broken. That was pushing, that was helping drivers push each other to drive better. And
yeah,
I just think
that race was,
that needs to go. I hope that Mossy feels somewhat vindicated right now.
I don't know if it vindicates anybody. It really just gets to a, I don't know. It really gets you thinking, like, what in the hell are we watching every week? Like, what?
Yeah.
It's not enough that, you know, maybe we're going to see some strategic calls, or we're going to see some, you know, we're going to see some weather or something like that. But now we have the referees, so to speak, to deal with. And I don't know. Nobody wants to deal with that crap. I mean, it's just like, come on. It really, while there was a lot of action, I'll say that. There was a lot of action in the racing. The racing wasn't even that bad. It was pretty decent. We got, you know, some overtakes. There was a lot of stuff that happened in the back of the pack. You know, finally someone has led a lap other than Max Verstappen in what, like 250 laps. So that, you know, there was a lot of good that I think came of it. It wasn't all bad, but the bad just for me just leaves such a poor taste in my mouth that.
Yeah.
The 2024 schedule was dropped. We have some sustainable fuels in 2026. We'll talk about. Lewis asked a great question. Should teams be allowed to work on the car this early for the following year? And Nikita Mazepin lost his lawsuit. We'll talk a little bit about that and some implications maybe, or just thoughts on that. Let's first jump into the F1 schedule. What stood out to you? First of all, we've got 24 races. Mm-hmm. Again, as you know, planned 24 races. China is back on the calendar, and F1 is promoting that as China's back on the calendar for the first time since 2019, which it was technically on this year's calendar as well for the first time since 2019, but they had to cancel it, which left us with a weird gap at the beginning of the year. They have tried, they claim, to regionalize some things. So we start in Bahrain, we go to Saudi Arabia, we end up in Australia, then go Japan, China. So that first half of the year, first, you know, five races or so, it's not bad. You know, like, it's semi-regional. It makes sense. And then there is... What else do we have? Then we go to Miami. Then we do the whole Miami, Imola, Monaco, Canada, which doesn't make sense, right? Yeah. And back to Spain, Austria, like that whole bouncing around where the European season kind of starts but doesn't start. that happens, and then we finish the year with the Las Vegas, Qatar, Abu Dhabi trio of races back to back. That's a triple header. Actually, I think do we have a quadruple header, or is that five races? So USA is October 18th through 20th. The following week is Mexico. The following week is Brazil. Oh, okay. Wait, that's okay. So we do. It's a triple header at the end of November. Sorry. Yeah. So it's November, December. Right. Okay. So basically end of the season with two triple headers separated by like 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Thoughts. What do you think? What do you think? What stood out to you? What are you excited for? Go for it.
I mean, you said it. It's supposed to be more regionally focused, although there's some asterisks there. But in the press release, F1 said on the regional flow of races that they're going to continue while being realistic to the fact that as a world championship, with climatic and contractual constraints, there will always be travel required that cannot be completely regionalized. I mean, we're talking about, I think, if we were to throw Miami, Austin, and Vegas all into, say, May, June-ish, we're talking potential triple digits every day for all three of those races, really. That would not be conducive, I think, to the health and safety of anyone participating in those races. So I understand that. I get why they're having to break that up. I mean, unfortunately, the races in the US are in very hot climates traditionally. So there's only really, I would say, between a September through, I would say, April, really, break in the weather to, I think, make for more appealing conditions. So I would maybe try and hope that down the road they push that Miami race to April. But, you know, because everyone who goes to Miami says it's absolutely miserable in May, unless you're from there, unless you're really used to the heat and the humidity together. A lot of people don't like that climate. So I love the fact that we have two other warm climates that are going to be in fall. I think that makes sense. I like that. So that kind of explains why the regionalized scheduling seems a little disjointed. They did explain that. I do also like how they changed the Bahrain and Saudi Arabian Grand Prix to Saturdays. This is supposed to accommodate Ramadan, which begins on Sunday, March 10th, and Bahrain was adjusted to assist in the logistics of that. So that explains that block of races. But yeah, I mean, standardized August break, the 3 week break between Brazil and Vegas. I do like that. I think that it also helps maybe F1 because this is the first year that we're going to be racing in Vegas in a very long time. Maybe it'll help them get the kinks out and maybe they can maybe extend on the activations going into the 2024 race. I'm excited about the 2024 season. I think it looks good. It looks promising. And hopefully China sticks to the schedule and doesn't, you know, change it again, because they've kind of gotten in a habit of doing that over the last couple of years. So hopefully China actually back and that they don't have COVID restrictions, you know, put back in place or anything that prevents that race from happening.
Yeah. I mean, those are COVID related.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously the country needs to get themselves in order to be able to host that type of event. I don't know. It's a good looking schedule. You know, I don't know. Do we need 24 races? No.
No, but the FI.
I'm a huge.
But F1 would essentially come out and say, well, it's not 25.
No, right. I'm really, you know, I'm a proponent of 17.
Yeah.
17 races, I think, is a good spot. I think that's it makes sense for everybody. I think when you add too many races, you know, yes, it's like a Super Bowl. Every race, great. You know, 75 million people watch each race or whatever it is worldwide. That's awesome. But, you know, what quality are you getting from these races that I think it's a real question that needs to be answered. It's a real part of the thought process. You know, is this actually doing us any good to host this many races?
Yeah.
What is the level of exclusivity that Formula One is known for? You know, is that, does it still exist? I would argue that the answer to that is no. It's starting to slowly whittle away, that the exclusivity.
For
good and for bad, right? They've made it clear that it's, that they don't necessarily want to cater to that audience anymore. The 70-year-old with money in their pocket, like Bernie used to say, was the only thing that was important. But at the same time, there is still a little something about Formula One that the exclusivity makes it, the sport itself is exclusive, right? When you're talking about only 20 drivers in the entire world and 10 teams, and you're not, you know, it's like you don't even want to allow any other teams to join. I mean, that's a, you have exclusivity. You know, why not have less races that teams can focus on, you know, building the cars, spending the money within, you know, if you had 7 less races to focus on your car, you know, maybe that's how the bottom teams start to pick up.
Yeah.
Right? That maybe that's how the bottom teams can catch up. Not with more races. You know, look at Haas. Was it last year? You know, all the damage that Mick caused to the car. Like, how is a team like that supposed to?
$2 million?
Oh, something ridiculous. Like, how does a team like that, who's already struggling, you know, to pick up sponsors or to make money, you know, to do anything with the cap limit? They couldn't even come close, first of all. How do you compete? You can't. You know, if there's 7 less races, can you compete? I don't know. Maybe. There's a good chance that you can focus more of your funds. And then if you added more teams, right, they don't have to worry about sustaining 24 races. They can worry about sustaining 17 races. Hey, that's a lot of easier of a task than 24 races. Now, I'm not saying it's an easy task at all. I'm saying it's easier than 24 races. You know, and the other thing too is like, how do we, I don't want to say diversify the races, but there's been a lot of talk of certain races not fitting the bill anymore, that are kind of boring. Maybe they're not really, you know, they're not as good as they can be. I'm looking at you, Mexico, Monaco. I mean, I still love Monaco. I think it's one of those races that needs to be on the calendar, but is it under fire? I'm not sure. But there's even races like Monza that could be, I've heard rumors that could be on the hot seat because they can't maybe afford to be on the calendar.
Yeah.
Some of these other races, right? Like France, like they just can't afford to be a race on it. So like, these are things that I think matter. Having a rotating amount of races, I think is the perfect answer, right? You have yourself a rotating 30 races maybe. And every other year, you know, you switch. It's like, okay, France hosts it this year and then next year they're not going to host it. Give them time to kind of recoup. You know, make sure they can put the best possible product on the board. You know, is that an answer? I feel like that could be an option for sure. But, you know, F1 needs to, again, prioritize competition, prioritize the on-track product, which we're seeing, I feel like, less of that.
Yeah.
Again, the calendar is not much different. It's actually really not different at all, in my opinion, in this year, other than a few things they switched around.
Yeah. Well, I mean, back to your point about Bernie Ecclestone, how he wanted to cater more to 70-year-old billionaires. I think right now there's a shift happening in F1 where it's kind of catering more now to influencers and to athletes.
Yeah.
And so that is now the target audience, because they know that it doesn't matter if you're if you invite a handful of influencers who have no idea what Formula One is, and you just know that that's an opportunity to put Formula One in front of millions of people that otherwise might not watch it, then they're going to start Googling it. And we know that we've talked about this several times. F1 drivers, they're pretty attractive. And that is a way to maybe get that new fan. And it's all about marketing. And F1, you can't say that they don't know what they're doing right now, because they know exactly what they're doing right now. And I think they're having to kind of dig deep right now to find, because we have talked about this, how they've kind of entered a moment where they could possibly start losing those DTS fans. And we'll talk about that. I'll let you talk about that later. But now they're having to say, okay, well, if we're going to lose some of the DTS fans, they don't have this emotional attachment, multi-decade attachment to Formula One. They don't care. Right. They could leave just as quickly as they came. Now we have to try and attract the sport to other audiences. And so enter the influencer, enter the 23-year-old with 15 million followers who's worth, you know, $50 million. That is that new target niche. And I hate to say it, I know a lot of people are going to cringe hearing that, but that's the truth. So it's, I think that when it comes to the schedule, F1 is going to keep the tracks that are sexy. They're going to keep the tracks that in the cities that I think have a lot of marketability to them. And that's going to be another driver, because remembering that F1 is also kind of a tourism broker, where they want as many people to come to these races as possible. So they're going to send advanced teams out there to film about the cities, about the food, the cultures, et cetera. And that is what's going to potentially draw some tourism and give some business to these cities that they race in. And so it's kind of a mutual partnership there. And you do that by putting this product in front of people who have the ability to amplify it out to millions and millions of people. So they know exactly what they're doing. And I think that, you know, looking at the calendar, again, we can go back to Miami, Austin, and Vegas, all in sort of a regional block on their own, that you would have to have it in a time frame that makes those places more desirable. You're not going to have people wanting to go to Las Vegas, you know, and then Austin and then Miami when it's over 100 degrees. People are going to be sweating profusely. There's nothing cute about that. So even with the regional blocks, they know exactly what they're doing with where they're placing these races in these really hot conditions.
Sure.
So.
Yeah. I mean, weather's definitely one thing to consider. There's obviously, other, like with Monaco, that's their weekend. They kind of owned that, right? So you can't mess with that. And there's just so many logistics. I don't envy the logistics of Formula One at all. I don't think that I'm not sure if there's a much tougher job in sports, right, than a global series with this many races. Yeah. You know, not only do the teams and the drivers and their families and all that need to kind of combat with the logistics of this, but you've got someone that actually has to plan it. You have someone that actually has to put this together. Yeah. So we'll see. Well, I mean, again, for me, 24 races is just too much. I know that they're planning on more and more and more until they, you know, get to whatever the number is, 25, 30 races, but I just want the product to be good. And if the product is good for 24 races, great. I don't know how you do that. I don't know how you keep that going.
Yeah.
So we'll see. We'll see what happens there.
Speaking of keeping things going, do hybrid engines make sense with F1 moving towards sustainable fuels in 2026? What are your thoughts on this?
Interesting question. I think they can do without the hybrid systems and just keep the sustainable fuels. Focus on building sustainable fuels for the, especially for, you know, listen, there's so many automobiles in the world that are not going to be hybrids, even, you know, even though you're building out all these hybrids and whatnot, and companies are building electric cars, that's fine. Doesn't mean everyone's going to suddenly have a hybrid or that suddenly everyone's going to have an electric car, which means you need to worry about all of the vehicles. And it's not just cars, right? What about like in trucking, in, you know, excavation equipment, you know, all everything, anything that uses fuel, heating homes, all that stuff. I think the focus should be on worrying about the sustainable fuels and let them run in V10s. I'm a big V10 or V8.
Yeah.
Just saying V10 or V8 doesn't mean that these motors are, you know, they're not big block, you know, 5.7 liter engines that you find in, you know, pickup trucks. They're not. They're smaller displacement. They're very efficient. And Sebastian Vettel proved that you can drive these things at a very, very high output. I mean, even in the old cars, right? Like in the, didn't he take out the Williams, the FW14? Mm-hmm. And he ran it with sustainable fuels. And the thing was quick. That's my take. Don't, you know, enough with this hybrid. But I will add this before I let you add your thoughts on this one. The 2026 engine entries like Audi are joining under the fact that there's hybrid, because for them it's important to continue researching and developing hybrid systems for their road-going cars. So they're not going to change. Even they're going to use sustainable fuels in hybrid systems. That's what they're going to do. There's not going to be, like, those engine manufacturers are joining because of that.
Yeah.
So that's the dilemma.
Yeah.
If there is one.
I mean, I was going to say, you know, there's still, I think it's 1 in 7 cars sold globally is electric. So they still have a lot of ground to cover when it comes to actually getting people to switch from ICEs mm-hmm. to electric. But I think a lot more people are starting to understand the environmental and human tolls that lithium battery creation causes. So a lot of people are saying this appears to be less motivated by climate change and more motivated by capitalism. And that in itself is starting to turn a lot of people off to the whole notion of electric vehicles. And so I'm curious to find out what the electric vehicle sustainability sector of the market feels about sustainable fuels, and would sustainable fuels change how they view the switch to electric? So I think a lot of that is going to maybe be a motivating factor to what Formula One does, because F1 is kind of used to installing different things that mm-hmm. are going to eventually be picked up by commercial road car manufacturers. There's certain technology that they want to put in their cars. And so I think maybe that could kind of be that reverse Uno, so to speak. But I don't think that F1 is going to backtrack and reinstate V8s or V10s, because like you said, there's way too much R&D that has gone into developing the hybrid. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think what they're trying to say right now is that we understand that there are a lot of people who think that F1 should have gone electric a long time ago. We don't agree with that. So we came to a middle ground of the hybrid engine. So now we're doubling down on that by saying that we are going to use sustainable fuels to continue to push the narrative of why we're keeping our engines the way we are and why we're not, you know, because there's already an electric series that we don't need to have two. And then what, F2, F3, F4, even in karting, they go down to electric. I think that would take a lot of the spirit away from Formula One. And I think that what this does is it respects the R&D while also respecting the pro ICEs and the pro electric crowd. So I think this is that good middle ground that they've established. That's why I don't think, I would love to see the V8s and the V10s come back. I think that it is possible, but there's so much money that's already gone into this. And it, unfortunately, this, like you said, it affects the engines coming in for 2026. They wouldn't backtrack that now.
Yeah, I have zero thoughts that it's going to happen. Not at all one of those things that I'm like, oh man, this could happen. It's not going to happen.
Unfortunately.
And there's, you know, obviously, like you said, there's, as soon as there's financial implications for things to happen or not, usually you have to follow the money and you have to go with, you know, what that looks like. And right now there's just too much tied up in the 2026 regulations, updates, all of that good stuff that we're not going to see it. And so, and then the other thing too is, you know, they want to go sustainable fuels. They have fuel partners. Look at all the oil partners that are in F1. You have to keep kind of, I don't want to say you have to, but you've got to keep everybody happy. So how do you keep the new manufacturers joining happy? Okay, they want hybrids. Great. How do you keep the oil companies, I don't want to say happy, but, you know, how do you keep them involved? Well, we're going to keep using fuel. We're not going to go full electric, right? Yeah. You know what I mean? So it's like hybrid ends up being the best middle ground for everyone. Everyone meaning whoever's putting money into Formula One. Happy. Mm-hmm.
It comes to the fuel partners, it forces them to also think outside of the box. It forces them to kind of see this new technology emerging within sustainable fuels and say, how can we be a part of this? And this is, you know, people can say, oh, that's not right, but this is capitalism at its finest. They see a product and they're like, okay, well, we want to have a part in that too. We're big oil. We're the biggest oil manufacturers in the world. So we want a piece of that too. And it forces them to create that and to compete in that market. Yeah. And that's ultimately, I think the competitive nature of the development of product is ultimately what makes a product better. If you only have one iteration of that product, then nobody's ever going to be competing to make that product better. You're just going to accept the product for exactly what it is. And so I do think that this does encourage these other major big oil companies to get involved in that and to say, how can we make this even better every single year? And that is something that I think, you know, if you are truly an environmental activist, if you really are concerned with climate change, that is something that you should be excited about. It doesn't matter if it's Aramco. It doesn't matter if it's Shell. It doesn't matter what the manufacturer is that's pushing that. You should appreciate that. There's a lot of money that goes into that. And it's a huge decision for companies to say, yes, we make all of our money. We make trillions of dollars off of oil production, well oil production, but now we're gonna shift. And I think for a company to do that and say, we have our bread and butter, we have the product that has made us so much money and a global force, but now we're going to switch to something else. I think that is also taking ego out of the equation maybe and saying, okay, there's this product, we need to explore it.
Right.
So I'm excited about it.
I would never want to see it go F1 go full electric. Like you said, we already have a full electric series and it's just fine for what it is. There's no need to, you don't need to introduce another one. And I think that there is more to F1 than just like, oh, we're just going to, we'll just go electric. Like, no, this whole series is built on the fact that there's technological advancements. It's creating the newest thing. Find us the newest thing.
Yeah.
You know, find us the next best thing. That's what F1 has always been about. And I think that, you know, the spirit of the sport and the research and the minds that are involved, that's where they should be focused. You know, they don't need to be focused on just accepting, you know, electric or accepting certain, I think they would be compromises to the spirit of the sport, yeah. But and they're not, you know, they're not, let's face it, they're not. So it'll be interesting to see if there's any actual debate over any of this, or, you know, if we'll hear more about it, because, you know, as we've learned, just because something is written down or supposedly set in stone with F1, they can change it whenever they choose.
Yeah.
And I think maybe this could be something else that, you know, we're in 2023. We're halfway through 2023. We have no idea how the world's going to change between now and then.
Yeah.
You know, what if we end up in a fossil fuel crisis? I don't know. What if we end up in, you know, a lithium crisis? I don't, you know, I have zero idea because I'm not tapped into all of this. But what if at some point there is a shortage of certain things? Like, how does that change everything? Yeah. Right? We just assume that all of these resources are endless, and maybe they are to an extent. I don't know. But I think the only truly renewable is nuclear, isn't it? Maybe. Or one of the only.
I believe so.
Like, truly I've gotten really interested in naval history and, like, just ever since the submarine thing happened, right? I've just been kind of going down like a rabbit hole. Yeah. And it's like, it's fascinating what a lot of the military applications. One of my best friends, his father served on the USS Nimitz aircraft carrier. And I started looking things up, and like, it is fully powered by, you know, nuclear motor or nuclear engine, nuclear whatever, and nuclear reactor. That's the word I was looking for. And it literally can, it's only essentially limited by the humans on board that need to refuel and, like, food they need to get. Like, it could literally run for pretty much ever.
Yeah.
Like, it never has to leave the water. It never has to charge up or anything, which is fascinating, right? And there's plenty of submarines as well. Submarines do the same thing. A lot of those submarines built right here in Connecticut, where I grew up, and which is really cool. So I got into, like, this whole rabbit hole. But it's like, wow, that's fascinating, right? To me, that's, like, super fascinating. Yeah. Like, that's actually renewable and something that is – it's clean. Yes, it's also – you know, dangerous, but it's very clean and it's very, very renewable. I don't know. Anyway, just a side thought about my own rabbit holes. But I know you've got a little rabbit hole that you went down about Nikita Mazepin. So I want to talk about that in a little bit. But before we get into Nikita, your boy, Lewis Hamilton, he made a comment late last week, maybe it was, or early this week.
Yeah.
About, because Red Bull came out and said that they already started working on next year's car, which of course brought up a whole bunch of people saying, well, wait a minute, these guys were penalized. How are they already working on next year's car? Well, first of all, the massive lead they have in both the drivers and the constructors helps, because they don't need to continue developing this car, or I guess they don't have to put tons of resources into it. But, what do you think about, like, what do you think? Should teams be allowed to work on next season's car this early in the year? Or, like, should, like, I think Lewis suggested, like, oh, you can't work on it till August 1st. Yeah. I think that's what he said. I think that's, what are your thoughts?
I have a couple of thoughts. I mean, first off, Verstappen's response to when he was asked about Lewis's comment was, life is unfair as well. It's not only an F1. A lot of things are unfair in life, so we just have to deal with it. I mean, have you ever heard a more Max response than that? I mean, that's just iconic Max. But mm-hmm. I will say that to his other statement that we weren't talking about that when Lewis was winning his championships, he's also said, I don't think we should be talking about it now. Something to consider, and this is a big, big thing that sticks out, is that while this is all true, when Mercedes was dominating, there wasn't a cap. So this isn't an apples to apples argument. You could spend unlimited amounts of money to develop whatever you wanted to. And so there were no time parameters. There were no budgetary parameters. There was just nothing really in place that could prevent somebody from gaining a competitive advantage. And so
sure.
I think that when you look at how much the cap has impacted Mercedes, just for example, they have won one race since 2022 when new aerodynamic regulations were introduced. One race. So, you know, yeah, they were dominating when they had unlimited amounts of money to spend. Now Red Bull is dominating where we don't have unlimited amounts of money to spend. But at the same time, if Red Bull is spending this year's cap money on next year's car, shouldn't that be a cap violation at the very least? Because that's money that they're spending that they should be spending next year. So how is that going to factor in with the 2023 budget when they're actually being audited? So is that truly gaining a competitive advantage by allowing them to spend, you know, what, $10, $15, $25 million on the next car within this year's budget? That's that gray area that I think, you know, if I were Red Bull, I would have kept that under wraps. I wouldn't have said, yeah, I'm starting to work on next year's car already. I mean, we knew that they probably were. We've said so a couple times on this podcast that was likely, you know, the likely case scenario. But if I were Red Bull, I wouldn't have said that, because I think now they're opening themselves up to another major audit. And maybe they don't care because they saw what the consequences were for, quote unquote, spending too much money on catering. And maybe they just don't care because they don't see this as that much of a risk to them. They see it as, oh, maybe we're given another deduction in the wind tunnel. Who cares? By that time, we'll already be leaps and bounds ahead of our competition for, you know, 2025. So it's, you know, I like I said, Max's comment, valid. Life isn't fair, but life also kind of gets a little into a gray area when you're actually not acting within good faith in that cap. And you're being very public about it too.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I don't know. I think it could be too, you know, do we go conspiracy theory here with it, or do we go, reality? Are they doing it because they don't? They're not. They're truly just not afraid of what the FIA will or will not do. Because clearly, like, look at the minuscule penalty that they got for, you know, for this, for the other penalty, you know, for the other infraction. So are they just like, screw it, they're not going to do anything to it? Or are they being public because they're like, okay, if we're public about it, we can always use that as kind of like defense. Like, look, we were public about it. No one said anything to us. Mm-hmm. Now all of a sudden you're saying it's a problem, yeah. Right? Like, is that... I don't know. I have zero idea if that's the case, but I don't know. If I think about it, if I'm Christian Horner and if I'm Christian Horner and Co., I'm saying, you know what? Let's just be upfront about it. If there's an issue, we'll hopefully hear it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I like to think that they're doing it to just be like, yeah, we're way better than you guys right now.
Yeah.
And
well, one thing,
we're already, it's an intimidation thing too, right? Imagine if you are a team that is like actively trying to develop your car for this season as if you're going to compete with Red Bull. Right. First of all, so at this point, so think about this. Like, this is actually very interesting. You are a team that knows you're not going to compete with Red Bull this season. It's which is every team, yeah. Right? Maybe Aston, but they don't have two drivers. So like, you're not, even if you do compete to that point, I say Aston. Mercedes is clearly proven that they're picking it up. So like either one of those teams, right? But do you even focus on the car this year if you're Mercedes? You have to, because you want to finish first. You want to finish, not first. You want to finish second. You want to finish third in the standings in order to make more money for next season, right? So you have to continue. You have to keep pumping money into, you know, the car. Whereas Red Bull's like, we don't even have to at this point. We're so far ahead. We could just focus on next year's car. No big deal about this season. You, rest of teams, need to focus on it because now you're all jockeying for position. You're all jockeying for whether it's second, third, fourth, fifth, seventh in the standings so that you can get yourself more money. We're already locking up first. We know that.
Yeah.
Right? Isn't that like, think about the insane amount of intimidation that creates.
Well, Aston Martin has already said that Red Bull shifting its focus to 2024, even though it has reduced wind tunnel time later in the season, might be its only chance to win a race this season. Like,
that's true.
Not far, you know, fetched. It's, we all agree with that, but one thing that Lewis said was that we want to see better racing. I think that was the quote that I think a lot of people are missing
Thanks, Lewis. Thanks for telling us what we don't know.
We want, and again, I think anytime somebody says that, it gets buried because we all know that. That's the most captain obvious statement you can make right now. We all know that. But then again, this all comes back to why the cap is so problematic. And I mean, we talk about this all the time, but you know, it's not exactly like it is letting other teams catch up, you know, and I've heard a lot of people talking about several different teams. I mean, people saying that they're more impressed this season with Williams than they are with Alfa Romeo. And I mean, it's creating some level of, you know, shift happening on the lower end of the spectrum, but it's not doing anything really to change the outcome of, you know, how people perceive Formula One. Because these races are becoming extremely predictable. And that's not, obviously it's not making for better racing. That's, I mean, and now you've got Red Bull saying, yeah, we're working on next year's car. Fuck it. Like, you know.
Which is, again, like I said, it's, you know.
It's not their fault.
Intimidation listen, I'm not one to sit here and say like, oh, you know, Ferrari sucks, Mercedes sucks, oh, it's not fair, it's not fair. No, like Max said, life's not fair. It happened. Like, this is how it is. They've got the best car. I mean, there's no denying that. They have the best, and they deserve everything they're doing. Like, it's fine. I think the gripe is, or the question is, should be, whatever you want to say, why is it so, you know, this is a question I get from so many people that I converted to being fans of F1. Why is Red Bull so, how are they just so much better? If they all have this same cap, you know, Ferrari's been around forever. You know, Mercedes is Mercedes. How are they not able to compete.
Yeah.
What is the reason? And I'm like, the only answer I ever really have is I'm like, they've got Adrian Newey.
Yeah.
And of course, people are like, who's Adrian Newey? Who's Adrian Newey? I'm like, wait, you know, blah, blah, blah. You explain who Adrian Newey is, and you're just like, okay. But other than that, like, what are they doing that's like so much better? It's got, there has to be like a system thing. That, at least that's where my head goes. Like, there has to be a reason why they are just so much better, other than, oh, we just have better. No, you know what? You can't tell me, oh, we just have better engineers. We just have better, you know, yes, Adrian Newey, I will say that's the X factor. But other than that, all of these teams have massive teams and millions of dollars. Like, I don't want to say it's a completely level playing field, but it's pretty damn level when it comes to the amount of money these teams can spend and, you know, the people they have working for them. We're talking about the best of the best here, right? We're not talking like, yeah, okay, one team's got Vincenzo Landino as their lead engineer. No, like, I'm not sitting there working for Williams and trying to be a, you know, build an engine. It's not, they've got top guys too, just because, you know, Red Bull's succeeding and Williams might not be, doesn't mean that, you know, that they've got crappy personnel. So, yeah, I kind of went off on that one, but like, it's, I'm going to just stop.
Yeah.
I'll just stop.
I don't know where we go, because again, it's not Red Bull's fault. It's, you know, it's not like teams don't have, you know, a budget cap on what they can spend on their facilities. You know, they can make state of the art. They can have better data analysis systems put in place. They can do as much mm-hmm. R&D as they want to when it comes to how they assess the data, when it comes to how they actually, you know, determine the things that I think really go into the microscopic elements of what makes this car what it's supposed to be. And are they really using that to the max advantage right now? I don't know. That's debatable, but maybe this is also sort of the no cap era hangover, where teams didn't really have to work within a budget. They didn't have to plan things years in advance, because they could just say, if something's not working, well, screw it. Let's throw $10 million at the problem and fix it. They can't do that anymore. So they have to be creative, and maybe Red Bull has just cracked the code on creativity. I don't know what other teams can do to say, well, you know, Red Bull has this insane competitive advantage. Well, again, unless they've cracked some code, or unless they're absolutely doing something completely outright illegal, which, you know, there's no evidence to suggest that. There's no proof of that. Like, that's just, that's another conspiracy theory without any legs at all. You know, it's kind of like, you just accept that this is Red Bull's world right now. You just exist in it. And unless your team decides to really start investing in everything they can to, within, you know, the financial either cap or within the boundaries, that this is just how it's going to be. I mean, I think right now it's, we have a cap, so let's get as creative as humanly possible. And I think for mm-hmm. Mercedes, they're saying, screw it, let's focus on next year's car. But maybe that's also a decoy too. Maybe that's them saying, yeah, we're focusing on next year's car, but really we're putting everything we have into this year's car. Knowing that regulations for next year aren't going to really change. So everything that we're doing this year is also mm-hmm. going to apply to next year's car.
So I think it's going to be a tough next couple years, especially until we get to 26, which, you know, is the regulation set going to be so much different, which, you know, it should be, but I think that I think Red Bull is set up for another, you know, 2 or 3 year run here, and you know, we could be looking at 5 in a row before we see any changes. And I don't know if, I mean, listen, we've talked about this so many times on the show. F1 is a series of streaks, you know, or a series of, I don't want to say dynasties, but, you know, you've always had eras of different teams, and this is no different, right? This is just yet another one in the long line of Formula One. But is it coming? And I posed this question, or I kind of talked about this a little bit on Twitter. You know, is this coming at a time when you've got more eyeballs than ever? You've got social media that is, you know, amplifying everything. So if people feel like a race sucks, more people feel like it sucks because they're reading about how much it sucks from other people, right? It's not just like, ah, that race sucked, and you talk about it with your people at home and that's it. It's, you know, you're amplifying it to millions more people. It's no longer just like, oh, I read about it in the newspaper, or I saw it on, you know, highlight sports show, and that's it. It's like, no, you actually are communicating with others about this, and you're creating more of that negative attitude or positive attitude, yeah. Right? It goes both ways. But negative vibes go a lot further than positive yeah. ones.
What's the confirmation bias too?
And then there's that. So
yeah.
Again, I think it. Listen, I'm not saying that, you know, squash Red Bull, or you need to. I don't want to see them bring about some technical directive. I never thought it was right for, you know, when it was done with other teams. I don't think it's right for them to do it to purposely, you know, kill off Red Bull. And I think Domenicali, I believe, also said that too. Like, it would be wrong for us to do it here, which is like, okay, dude, it's a little bit hypocritical because you did it with Ferrari and Mercedes in the past, but whatever.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to see that. That's not the spirit of the sport. That's not the spirit of competition. You shouldn't have to implement a technical directive just to, you know, weaken a team so that, you know, others can compete. If you can't build a car, you know, going back to Christian, change your fucking car. So yeah, you know, like I, but figuring out why is the exercise that should be happening yeah. right now. Like, hey, what is happening that this discrepancy is so great? There's been discrepancy across the sport. That's fine. But again, figure out why it's happening still when you're claiming to be fixing those types of issues.
Yeah.
Or when you claim to want to fix those types of issues.
Yeah. No, I agree.
Yeah. Okay, Mazepin, I know you had some passionate thoughts about Nikita Mazepin, and you wanted to talk about them. He lost a lawsuit arguing against sanctions that bar him completely from F1. I don't really have thoughts on this, so like I'd rather just hear someone intelligent. My only thought is like, dude, you suck anyway.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
What intelligent thoughts do you have on this one?
Well, it's not like a passionate response to this. It's just, you know, 3 weeks ago, Mazepin lost a suit against the UK government and the High Court to have sanctions against him lifted. As people know, him and his father, they were deemed as close assets to Vladimir Putin. They had a travel ban imposed that prohibits them from traveling within the UK, and they imposed an asset freeze. So basically, Mazepin's attorneys argued that the sanctions were draconian, but the attorneys who represented the UK said that sanctions were a key aspect in how the public in the UK perceived the war with Ukraine. So, you know, his attorney said the sanctions were costing him potential racing roles. But it's funny because in the ruling, the judge said he was satisfied with the evidence against granting Mazepin interim relief and didn't feel like Mazepin had any shot it's signing with an F1 team until sanctions were lifted, meaning there was no interest in Mazepin by a Formula One team, even as a reserve driver. So, you know, if there's no interest in him now, then obviously there won't be any interest, you know, in him until sanctions are lifted. And when those sanctions are lifted will be determined on how long this war goes on. So Mazepin, he has another hearing on July 19th. He claims to have an army of legal colleagues who think he can have a shot at returning to the sport. Keep this in mind. Mazepin never raced in Formula One. There's 20 seats. And there are a lot of drivers with a tremendous amount of experience who would fill one of those seats if need be better than Mazepin. I mean, call it what it is. His dad had to buy a team essentially, or buy, you know, key sponsorship on a team just to get his kid a seat. If he was that good of a driver, he would have had a team wanting him straight away. So, you know, to your point, he sucked. That's all there is to it. And I think he can continue to, you know, go the legal route. But it's going to be an uphill battle for him in this legal spectrum. It's going to be an uphill battle for him to get a seat, even if sanctions are lifted. I just think that he's using the legal system right now to keep his name relevant. And I think that's kind of more what this is. He doesn't want to be forgotten about. And obviously we're, you know, I'm doing his bidding right now by talking about this, but I think there's a lot of people who maybe they are concerned that, you know, Mazepin could, not concerned really, you know, in a sense that there's a war implication here, but that he could potentially come back to F1 if sanctions are lifted because his dad could potentially buy him back in to Formula One at the expense of another driver losing a seat.
So yeah. Like I said, I think the only answer that I, you know, for me is just that he's just not good enough. Like, yeah. Dude, what leverage do you have? Nobody wants anything to do with, you know, your father right now, which was your only saving grace, yeah. You know, to your point. So, I mean, that, like, to me, it's even from a competition perspective, forget about the money. It's like you said, there's 20 drivers. There's only 20 of them. You are the one of the best. Like, okay, listen, can he hold his own? Sure, I guess he could. To somewhat, I can't believe I actually just said that. But like, dude, you are not one of the top 20 drivers in the world. I just watched Shane Van Gisenberg, Supercars champion, sit in a NASCAR for the first time and race around Chicago and win the race. Okay?
Yeah.
Like, dude is an absolute beast. Three-time champion, Supercars champion. You think Nikita Mazepin's better than that guy because he raced in Formula One? Yeah, okay, buddy. Like, yeah, you raced in Formula One. Just because you've got that check on your, you know, that notch in your belt, doesn't mean it was, you know, there's any merit to it. So, again, you're talking about so few seats. You're not one of these. You're not one of these people. And then on top of it, okay, let's say you do, you know, get through with this lawsuit, whatever. You really think a team is going to suddenly be like, yeah, we want Nikita Mazepin to be a driver? Like, we totally want this guy to drive for our team. Like, is that the case? So, I guess I had more thoughts about this than I thought I did originally, but I mean,
as is usually the case on the show.
Yeah. There's,
but yeah, anyway. That's that. I, you know, think about that what you will. I wouldn't think too heavily into it, mm-hmm. and I wouldn't put too much stock in him.
No.
To F1. I think this is definitely, like I said, this is not to keep himself relevant. It is what it is. So you have the final word today.
I do have the final word. I will try. I'm going to keep it to like a minute if I can, but well, I don't know. Will I keep it to a minute? I'll try to keep it to a minute. I guess a little bit of context maybe before I get into it. I definitely tweeted something out the other day about the F1, what I call the dilemma. You know, Max Verstappen at the end of the race decides, while he's up 24 seconds on Charlie Leclerc, that he's going to pit for fastest lap, which his teammate already had, which is fine. He's a competitor, and I'm all for the move. I don't see an issue with him going for fastest lap. He's a competitor. He's a race car driver. This guy wants to win. He wants to bludgeon the opponents. There's nothing wrong with that. But I tweeted, and again, not because it was Ferrari or anything like that, but just because I had this feeling. Like, F1 has a dilemma. Sacrifice racing for the overall spectacle to retain eyeballs brought in by Drive to Survive. But that sacrifice is now creating complications, let's just say. My opinion is this. Great racing is truly great spectacle. You don't have to manufacture spectacle. You don't have to manufacture an event to make it any better if the racing is good. The racing itself is the spectacle. The racing itself is what keeps people interested. The racing itself is what will make everybody happy. If you have great racing, you're satisfying the people that have been here forever, and you're also satisfying newbies, because now there's drama. People love drama. There's drama in the actual racing product. You know, my mom, I'll just use her as an example. She likes sports, but she's not like diehard anything. She will sit there and watch a good game. If a game is really good and it's coming down to the wire, she'll cheer for that team, you know, whatever, a team, just because the game is really good or the ending is incredible, right? So it's like suddenly it's like, Mom, you don't even care about this team. You watch the Steelers. You don't care about the Jets or whatever. She's like, yeah, but, you know, this game is so good. What? People like a good product on the field or on the pitch or on the grid, whatever it is. To me, if Formula One gets away from that, I think it's a slow death for the series. The main focus should be on making the racing better than it's ever been, or as good as they can, and not worry about all the other things, because that will come.
Yeah.
It will happen as a side effect of good racing, right? With good racing, you'll get all of the drama between the drivers, because things will happen, and, you know, there'll be real competition, real rivalries that will develop from that. You know, rivalries are what really create the allure of sport. There's so many great rivalries across so many different sports that we could talk about. And it is, and I'll, you know, I'll take the, my wife is an Ohio State grad, went to Ohio State. So Ohio State and Michigan hate each other in college sports, right? It is one of the greatest rivalries in all of sports. If not, could be one of like the oldest too. I'm not sure about that specifically, but that rivalry, right, is like, no matter what happens, it's like, you just need to beat that team. Doesn't matter if we win the national championship this year, if we didn't beat that team, it's a failure of a year, right? Like, that creates drama for those fans. Like, that's built in drama, no matter what. We don't have that right now. We don't really, you know, we got 1 year of that. So DTS fans had the joy of seeing a Max Lewis, an incredible year in 21. Absolutely one of the best seasons, right? And it hasn't been like that ever since. You know, we had it for half a year, a little bit last year, and then it was just like nothing. And then, of course, this year, there's absolutely no rivalry at all. Rivalry and great racing is what you want to create, but not manufactured. You know, yeah. not stuff that is being created off the grid, right? Like that kind of drama just doesn't do anybody justice.
Yeah.
It doesn't do the series justice. And I really don't know if or how long that can be sustained. I'm not going to say, oh, F1's dead. It's not dead. But I think that's how you can lose a lot of the momentum that you did build up. And I think that that's how you lose fans. You know, I can't tell you the amount of people that have reached out. And again, I am a one person in a much larger world here, but I can't tell you the amount of people that have reached out to me and are like, is this season going to get any better? Is like, this is boring. Like, this is not fun, you know, fun to watch anymore. This is not interesting. There's nothing for me. Like, why am I turning this on a Sunday morning? Like, there's nothing. Like, what am I watching? You know, or this guy, you know, okay, whatever. Maybe Matt, well, he hasn't been behind. So, like, that's the tough part. But, okay, Sergio's been behind, right? And then he's all of a sudden ahead by, like, 8 seconds. And it's like, well, how did he pass that guy and now he's ahead of him by 8 seconds? Like, how is that? That's not interesting. So again, like that's my one, my only thought, my last thought is just focus on great racing. Great racing is great spectacle. People will follow if what they're watching is awesome. Preach. Not because, you know, because the driver attractiveness of the drivers is only going to go so far. I'm not taking away from the people that are interested in that. That's awesome. But on the whole, that's not what's going to keep people, you know, coming back for more. First of all, you can't see the drivers once they're in their cars, right? I can't see who Charlie Leclerc, Vincenzo Landino in that seat. Doesn't matter. You know, like no one's going
to
know the difference.
I think you would be able to tell the difference when you started driving.
Well, yeah. Yes, yes. Oh, that is true. I meant from a looks perspective, right? Like you don't know the difference. You have no idea. So those types, you know, that trying to worry about that, which I'm not sure if like they're focusing there, but you know, the content and whatnot does lean a little differently now, but just create better product. Just get us a good product. Focus on what the system, what issues are with the system as a whole that are, is creating, you know, so much discrepancy. And that will fix I can almost guarantee you that fixes every problem if the racing is good.
Yeah.
So that's my final
word.
You
did not keep that under a minute, but I respect it.
I didn't. I didn't. That was like 7, I think. I don't know. That was, yeah.
We like it.
Oops.
It's a happy mistake.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's all we got today. Any parting words?
Nope, just gave my last parting words.
Like
we're
it.
Good.
Go sports. Yay team. I hope Silverstone is as good as it was last year, if not better. Speaking of great racing, we deserve that minus that accident last year. But everything else, we'll take it. If you guys like the show, give us a 5-star rating on any of your favorite podcast players. And Vincenzo, how can people find you on social media?
Vincenzo Landino on Twitter is the best place. Although now I am the Vincenzo Landino on Threads. Wow. So you could find me over on Threads too.
You ventured down another rabbit hole.
Yeah, I mean, that's Instagram. So like Instagram, the Vincenzo Landino. But Twitter is where you can find me with... For the most part,
I am on Twitter mainly. You can find me at the VF Castro on that and also on Instagram. That's all we got today. If you guys have any questions, concerns, drama, problems, I don't know, let's play therapist. Find us on social media or leave us a comment on the episode, and we'll get back to everyone on the next episode. Talk to you guys later.
Bye.
Thank you so much for tuning into the VF1 show. If you liked it, please don't forget to hit the subscribe button. And for previews of next week's show, follow us on Instagram and Twitter at the VF Castro and Vincenzo Landino.